Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Julian Chang. I am co-chair of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Member-Led Forum. Tonight's program is entitled Spice of Life, Growing Up Queer in India. And we have four superstar panelists that are with us. Before we introduce them, I'd like to welcome each and every one of our listening audience, as well as the audience here in the room at the Commonwealth Club. The Commonwealth Club is dedicated to informed discussion and setting truth free in the world. We've done this for 107 years, and we are glad that you are part of our efforts tonight. Tonight is part of an overall month-long focus that the Commonwealth Club is having on India. Our series is called India Now, and the Spice of Life program fits within that context of a panoramic view of the powerful forces in the subcontinent and beyond. With us tonight are Rakesh Modi, Dipti Ghosh, Devesh Katu, and Meenal Hajratwala. I'm sorry, Meenal. They are going to each speak to us, and then there will be questions that you are allowed to ask. Please write them on your comment cards and raise them in the air. They will be collected and passed up here. We will do our best to get to your questions. The Indian subcontinent is known for its diversity, and the diversity includes LGBT people of every persuasion, class, and social order. With us tonight is Rakesh Modi. Rakesh has been actively involved in the LGBTQ community for the last 20 years, starting in Mumbai, India, and then here in the Bay Area. He is the co-founder of Hum Safar Trust in India, which today is the largest non-government organization working in the MSN, which is men who have sex with men, and the transgender community for HIV prevention, and also provides support to the LGBTQ community. Rakesh also started a counseling service for gay and bisexual men in the early 1990s. After he moved to the U.S., Rakesh was involved in the South Asian LGBTQ community in the Bay Area by being on the board and serving as co-chair of TRACON, which is the oldest South Asian LGBTQ organization of its kind in the world. Currently, Rakesh serves as the co-chairperson of NQAPIA, a national federation of LGBTQ Asian American, South Asian, Southeast Asian, and Pacific Islander organizations in the U.S. Rakesh is being awarded the Pink Peacock Award, which is the highest honor given by TRACON once every 5 years for his contribution to the South Asian queer community. Welcome, Rakesh Modi.
Thank you, everyone. That was a warm welcome. But anyway, so let me talk a little bit about myself about growing up gay in India. I grew up in Mumbai, and I lived there through my mid-20s. And in India, if everyone knows, Bollywood has such a huge influence on our lives. As a kid, I felt attracted to the male actors in Bollywood, and I always was fascinated by the female actresses as far as what they wore. So. But, I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know anything about homosexuality. I didn't know the term gay, until, much later when I hit puberty, I kind of got bold enough and I seduced a neighbor who's my age. We basically, had sexual intimacy. But didn't call it anything, didn't have a name for it. Until one day I was going through my dad's porn collection stashed away in a closet somewhere. And I found a book, this huge big book, and it was titled something like The Art of Sex, or I you know, something weird like that. But so I was going through it, and it had all these, like, diagrams of, you know, sexual positions and things like that. And this book of, like, 200-some pages, there was 1.5 page, which was a chapter titled Homosexuality. And I happened to read it, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, it was like, you know, suddenly there's light bulbs flashing all over the place. It was like a realization that this is who I am. And then suddenly there's all these questions. Is this who I am? You know, it was just 1.5 pages, just very kind of clinical explanation of what homosexuality is and that sort of thing. But that just made me feel very scared and also very isolated, because I did not know anybody else who was gay, who had this attraction. You know, I had friends, older boys, older than me, in their teens, who I knew fooled around with each other and that sort of thing. And I thought it was very common, only that they also talked about girls and they, you know, were attracted to girls. I felt very different. But there was absolutely nobody that I could talk to. There was no mention of the word homosexuality, gay, anywhere. So I kind of shoved it, you know, under the rug, forgot about it, dated a girl in college. And that was going well, but, you know, something was missing. Because I would always look at the boys. And then when we broke up, I broke up with her over something very trivial. I kind of just sat down and said, you know what, I need to really rethink this, because if this is who I am, then I need to, there have to be other people that are like me. And I have to find, you know, other guys or girls who have same attractions like me. But where do I begin? Where do I start? And coincidentally, I read a newspaper article in one of the afternoon, like, tabloids. And this was a few people had started a newsletter called Bombay Dost. And that was the first gay newsletter. It was for gay men. Actually, it was for gay and lesbian. And so I tried, you know, to find out who these people were and how do I get in touch with them. And I finally, you know, long story short, I got in touch with them. And it was almost like I found home. I found a family. You know, it was started by one of the pioneer activists, gay activists in India, called Ashok Rao Kavi. The filmmaker Sridhar Rangayan. So, you know, these people became my closest best friends. And mind you, I was still not out to my family. I was, you know, I was doing a lot of work with Bombay Dost in 1994. We actually had hosted the first international gay men's conference in India, and we had people, delegates from the U.S., from Tricon, actually, attended, and from London and all over the world. But that brought attention to the government, and, you know, we basically brought across the point that we need information, we need a drop-in center, we need health services for men, because there was so less information about safer sex. There was, just less information about homosexuality in general. So finally, we brought attention to the government, and we were given a space to create a drop-in center. And we created a trust called the Humsafar Trust. We made it legal. I was one of the first trustees of Humsafar Trust in 1995. And that trust has grown today to be one of the leading organizations that employs several people, does a lot of HIV prevention work. It has a huge drop-in center in Mumbai. It has branches all over the country. So I'm very proud of Humsafar Trust and the work they're doing. I realized that there was not much counseling provided to the gay men in Mumbai, in India. So I wrote for a grant to International Gay and Lesbian Youth Organization, and I was given a grant to go to France to do a course in counseling, in queer counseling. So that's what I did. I went back to India and started a helpline so that people could call. There were a lot of gay and bisexual men who were married, would call, and we would set up counseling sessions. I trained a lot of people in Mumbai then, and then they have a successful helpline that's running in Mumbai, also a drop-in center. And then a lot of, like, the medical profession people have been associated with the Humsafar Center right now. After that, I moved to the U.S. I moved to the Bay Area, and then I already had ties with Tricon here. Tricon is, as you know, the first nonprofit organization in the Bay Area that serves the South Asian community, South Asian LGBT community. And I was on the board, and, you know, the rest is history. Also, right now I'm the co-chair of NCAPIA, which is the National Queer Asian Pacific Islander Alliance, which is basically a federation of organizations, LGBTQ organizations, South Asian, Southeast Asian, Pacific Islander organizations within the U.S. We just held a very successful summit in San Jose, and we're going to have our national conference in Washington, D.C. next year in July. So, you know, I welcome any questions if you have. I guess that's later on.
Thank you. Thank you, Rakesh. Our next speaker is Dipti Ghosh. Dipti Ghosh is a senior vice president of investments for a major financial services firm in San Francisco. She has been a leader for accountability to address violence in the local Asian and Pacific Islander queer community and participated in Asian Women's Shelters Transforming Silence into Action National Network of Advocates and Activists. She's currently board chair for the Center for Asian American Media and serves on the investment committee of Horizons Foundation. She has also been the past board chair of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission and Tricon, a South Asian queer organization. In 2007, she was the recipient of the Phoenix Award from the Asian and Pacific Islander Queer Women and Transgender Coalition. And in 2000, she received Tricon's Pink Peacock Award. When not developing investment plans to help her clients achieve their dreams, Dipti generously dedicates her spare time to supporting the needs of our community. You can find Dipti discovering the Greater Bay Area on her bicycle, skiing every chance that she can get, and traveling with Maggie, her partner of 16 years. Welcome, Dipti Ghosh.
Thanks, Julian. I'm not sure I recognize that person. Sounds like I've been around for a while, but the truth is I have. So, you know, I wanted to focus a little bit on my adolescence. And it does seem like a long time ago, but I still remember it, and it's it's actually has shaped a lot of where I spend my time today doing my activism. So, as many of you who are in this room who know me know that I was a tomboy. I always loved playing the games that I wasn't supposed to be playing. So, as pre-adolescent, most of my friends were boys, and, you know, I competed head-on with them, and I didn't really have much of an issue. And then as I became an adolescent, I found that I was supposed to change in some way that I wasn't changing. I was still enjoying the things the boys enjoyed. And I wanted to dress like the boys. I didn't want to shave my legs, pluck my brows, put on makeup, and all the young teenage girls were starting to think about those things. And I just had no interest in it. And living in India, that created quite a problem for me. In my own household, I was allowed to be whoever I wanted to. But when I walked out on the street, I was mercilessly teased. So somewhere inside, I got the message that I'm not what people expect me to be, but why do they find what makes me so comfortable so uncomfortable? So that really colored my teenage years. And I used to come home crying many a night and, you know, telling my dad about what was going on. And, you know, my dad was my big support because he always told me to be who I was. I didn't think I was going to get this emotional. I thought I was going to tell some jokes. But you know, it was a painful time. And there were many days that I didn't want to go out of the house because it was, I had to listen to people who didn't know me just calling me names, coming into my face, asking me if I was a boy or a girl, and, you know, telling me, why do you dress like that? You know, you should tell your parents to put a dress on you. And these were the comments I would hear all the time. And so, you know, people who know me in this room know that I'm a social animal. I love anything to do with hanging out with my friends. I will find a way to do that no matter what else I have to do. And that's what kind of pushed me. I would eventually get out of the house because I didn't want to be alone. And I would want to be hanging out with my friends, and I would end up there, going out of the house, being subjected to this barrage of comments, and then, you know, coming home. So this went on for a while, and people should know that I'm an Air Force brat. My dad was in the Indian Air Force. He was an officer in the Indian Air Force. And I lived all over India, and eventually my parents decided, you're going to boarding school because we can't put you in a new school every year. So I went to an all-girls boarding school. And for the first time in my life, I started meeting women who were into sports, who loved competing, and, you know, and suddenly I was happy to hang out with a bunch of girls. And, you know, I didn't ever meet girls like this because in boarding school, they forced you to have, you know, to be active. And, you know, for some reason, when I went to day schools, they never did that. So I got to play a lot of sports, and I was in seventh heaven. And as you might guess, you know, I started competing. I started liking these girls. And about 13, I got my first crush. And it was a big crush. And, you know, and seriously, at 13, I didn't know anything about my sexuality. I just knew I was in love with this girl. And she was a little older than me, so, but, you know, I didn't care. And it was a wonderful year. But in that year, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong, because I just felt, this is what I like. This is who I like. And what happened was this, I got teased again. And suddenly I realized what I'm feeling is not what I should be feeling, that I'm going to get made fun of, and I sort of shut down. And I really think the next 2 years was very miserable for me. And I sort of had this inkling that my life going forward was going to be pretty traumatic. And my parents decided to immigrate. And I thought, suddenly felt like maybe I have a chance here to do something different and maybe have a different life. So my mom decided they were coming to America, and my mom decided she was going to be the one to come first. And she wanted to come with somebody, and she chose me. And, you know, so I came here, and I think the first thing I felt when I went into a school here was this anxiety about what's going to happen when I walk in and people think don't know if I'm a boy or a girl. And I walked into, and it was just really traumatic. I walked in and nobody said anything. Nobody even noticed me. And I thought, oh my, I've reached the place where I can live and be myself. And I had no desire to go back to India. But I think that, you know, this whole experience of mine made me realize that how important it is that, you know, we accept each other for who we are. And so my whole adult life has been fighting for making sure that not only as queer people, but as South Asians, as people of color, as you know, as people who don't have as much access, you know, that there's a place for all of us. And so, you know, really, it has colored everything I do, and to this day. And so, you know, I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dipti. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is The Spice of Life, Growing Up Queer in India. Our next speaker is Devesh Katu. Born in Mumbai, India, Devesh moved to the U.S. to go to graduate school in 1990 and has been living in San Francisco for most of the past 19 years. Devesh works in development at Horizons Foundation, the Bay Area's LGBT Community Foundation, and has been working in the nonprofit sector for the last 10 years. Prior to that, Devesh worked in the software industry for 7 years before realizing that it wasn't his true calling in life. Devesh came out as a gay person after coming to the U.S., but has since made up for lost time. He is now openly gay and out to all his friends and immediate family. He has been involved with several organizations serving the Asian, LGBT, and HIV/AIDS communities, including current board service with Asian and Pacific Islander Wellness Center and past board service with Chacon, the lesbian and gay South Asian organization serving the Bay Area. In his spare time, Devesh's interests include running marathons, dining out, travel, independent and foreign movies, and board games such as Scrabble and chess. Welcome, Devesh Katu.
Thank you, Julian. I'm going to talk about my coming out process, but I'm also going to be talking about my role in activism because the two are kind of related. So as Julian mentioned, I grew up in India. I was born in Mumbai, and I grew up in Mumbai and Pune, which is a city about 100 miles from Mumbai. Even though I've been attracted to men since I was 5 years old or so, I guess I didn't know what it was all about then. But growing up, I was living with my family until I went to college. And even then, I lived in a dorm during the weekdays, but I came home over the weekends. So I didn't really have any time to explore my sexuality at all. In fact, I didn't even know what two men did when they got together. So coming to the U.S. provided me with that big break. I went to grad school in Austin, Texas, and that's where I decided to explore my sexuality. But there was a dearth of LGBT Indian people out there. There were exactly two that I eventually came to know about. So that was something that was definitely missing in my life. And when I finished my master's degree, I moved to the Bay Area to start working in the software industry. And that's when I got involved with Tricone. So I'd heard about Tricone while I was in Austin, but I first came across them in the LGBT parade in 92. And I signed up to be on the mailing list. But nothing happened for a few months. Then I got a call next year from Sandeep, who was one of the board members then, saying that they were reviving the group. The group had been dormant for a while. So I jumped at the opportunity because besides wanting to contribute, I also wanted to meet other LGBT Indians and establish my social network here, which I didn't quite have. So my activism began as a result of a combination of accident and self-servitude in that regard. So we reconstituted the board, and also at the same time, I, along with Marty, who was a friend of mine who lived in Cornell, who went to school at Cornell University. He was an IT administrator there and had access to their servers. So we founded a list called the Kush mailing list, which was an email list to meet LGBT Indians and South Asians around the world. At the same time, I also started the Tricone website, the first ever Tricone website. And we also did things like participate in the India Day Parade for the first time in the Bay Area. As a result of all these things, it was just inevitable that sooner or later, my friends in college would find out. So one day I got a call from one of my closest friends who asked, Devesh, are you gay? because he had come across my name somewhere in the ether. Of course, we didn't have Google back then, but still, there were news groups. And he came across my name across one of the news groups. So, yes, I told him that I was gay, and he actually was very liberal and very accepting of the fact, which was great. But once one Indian knows a secret, the whole Indian community knows about it. So it wasn't long before all my other friends also came to know about it. I had conversations with my closest friends. Some of them talked more about it than others. The others just didn't talk about it, but still were very accepting. More recently, Facebook has also greatly facilitated the process, because there have been people who have not been in touch with for 25 years, especially high school classmates, who if they send me a friend request, I accept it, but then I'm openly out on Facebook, and obviously that enables me to come out to them. And so far, none of them have really been any have been antagonistic about it. So in terms of my coming out to my immediate family, I started the process when my sister got engaged in 1999. So I didn't want this to become a problem after her marriage. And so I told her and her fiancé before they got married. So my sister was very supportive. She just said that just take care of your health. And she also said, don't tell my mom, because we didn't think that my mom would be ready for that at that time. My mom visited me in a couple of years after that, in 2001, when I was living with a partner. And he had, we were living in a two-bedroom apartment, and the story that we made up was that he had kindly vacated his room for my mom, similar to the Wedding Banquet movie. So I thought that she might have figured it out, but it turned out that she was just clueless. I'd been meaning to tell her for a long time, and but the problem was that every time I went back to India, it was for a couple of weeks, and the time was just too short. But finally, in 2010, last year, I got the break that I was looking for. During the first week that I was there, she mentioned that so-and-so had this girl who was ready for marriage, and now that I was 40 years old, I should think about settling down, because I'll be all alone when I'm old. So I said, Mom, the problem is that I'm not interested in girls, so why do you keep referring these girls to me? So I thought maybe she got it then, because she changed the topic and we talked about something else. But a couple of days later, it was apparent that she hadn't, because she was reading the newspaper, the Times of India, and it so happened that there was an article about these two guys in Mumbai who had a ceremony of some sort. Obviously, you couldn't get married officially in India, but they had some kind of ceremony, and there were some pictures about it. So she pointed it out to me and said, hey, look at these two guys. They're getting married. So I sort of seized that as a cue and told my mom that, by the way, I'm sure that you know that I'm also gay. And so she was silent and pretended that she was completely shocked about it, which I find hard to believe. But anyway, we had a conversation after that for about 10 minutes. We talked about Proposition 8, which had just taken place in California the previous year. And then she also asked me whether I'd always been this way or whether it was after going to the U.S. I told her that... I told her, no, that hadn't corrupted me. It was always the way I was. So finally she said that, okay, well, that's fine, but she didn't approve of the lifestyle. I mean, I think she was referring to the fact that of two men getting married. But the conversation ended out there. But nevertheless, that was about halfway during my visit out there, and the second half of the visit was just fine. There was no difference in her reaction to me. She treated me just as well. She prepared all my favorite food and sweets and so on. So I just took that as acceptance. But we haven't actually talked about it since. So even though don't ask, don't tell might be dead in the military, it still lives on as far as me and my mom is concerned. My sister did kindly agree to talk to her if the need arose, but I guess she hasn't broached the topic yet. But our relationship seems to have improved, because we do talk about everything else just fine, and but I'm quite comfortable with the knowledge that at least she knows about my sexuality and I don't have to hide it anymore. I think that's it for me.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Minal Hajratwala. Minal is the author of Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents, published in 2009, which has been called incomparable by Alice Walker and searingly honest by The Washington Post. The book won a Penn USA Award, an Asian American Writers Workshop Award, a Lambda Literary Award, a California Book Award, and was shortlisted for the Sorian International Writing Prize. She spent 7 years researching and writing the book, traveling the world to interview more than 75 members of her extended family. Minal is a Fulbright Senior Research Scholar, spending 2010-2011 academic year in India researching a novel while also writing poems about unicorns of the 5,000-year-old Indus Valley civilization. She is the editor of the Queer Ink Anthology, Contemporary LGBT Stories of India, forthcoming in 2012 from Queer Ink Publishing. Her creative work has received recognition and support from the Sundance Institute, the John Sims Center for the Arts, the Serpent Source Foundation, and the Hedgebrook Writing Retreat for Women, where she has served on the Alumni Leadership Council. Her one-woman show, Avatars, Gods for a New Millennium, was commissioned by the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco for World AIDS Day in 1999. As a journalist, Minal has worked for the San Jose Mercury News from 1992 to 2000 as an editor, reporter, and the newspaper's first reader representative or an ombudsman. She was a National Arts Journalism Program Fellow at Columbia University in 2000 and 2001, and she is a graduate of Stanford University. Welcome, Minal.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here back in San Francisco. I'm just back from 10 months away in India, and so this panel is really timely for me, as one of the things that I've been doing in India is collecting stories of LGBT people, and a lot of those are coming out stories. And so I'll talk a little bit about that and sort of what's going on right now in India from my perspective. But maybe before I do that, I'll just share a little bit about my personal story. I was born in San Francisco and grew up in New Zealand and then in Michigan. And then I went to college, and I came out in college in a feminist studies kind of environment. And I came out in quite a tumultuous way. I first came out to myself, and then I was outed to my parents, and so it was not the ideal set of circumstances in which to have a calm and careful conversation. And I also had been basically lying to my parents for some years, so they were hurt and betrayed and reacted in a way commensurate with that. And so I had quite a lot of drama in my 20s, and my relationship with my family was quite strained and distant. And then somehow I ended up with the genius idea of writing a book about my family, which led me to really become intimate with my family and the stories in my family in a way that I had not ever thought that I would feel close to my family again. And I ended up traveling the world. My family right now is in 9 different countries, and the book Leaving India is the story of how that happened and how those migrations happened over the last 100 years. And in the process of doing that, I found that I needed to again navigate the coming out issue, which I thought I had more or less settled when I was 19, but there I was in at 29, 30, meeting relatives that I hadn't been very close to, and confronting the question of when I was going to get married and why I wasn't married yet. And I found that although I had been a radical activist and a writer and been publishing and performing quite brazenly, I was still hesitant to come out. And I came out to some people, and I avoided the question with other people. And I just sort of observed my own behavior and watched how this question of my sexuality was still quite
deeply threatening and somehow, in some sense, deeply conflicted in the sense of being so different and so divergent from what was expected of me within the world of my family. So in the process of writing the book, I really wrestled with these issues. And, of course, when the book itself came out, then I was suddenly very, very out. And my recommendation is that if you do need to come out to a lot of people at the same time, it's great to do it on the covers of magazines and things like that, because then they're like, oh, well, on the one hand, she's a lesbian, but on the other hand, look, she's famous. It's very exciting. So that's a little taste of my story. I have come to understand for myself queerness as another kind of migration, a migration from the kind of structured, traditional world of my family to a kind of new and unbounded world in which a lot seems possible. And so for me, that metaphor of migration has been helpful to understand my own journey and also to put my own story in the context of all of the other stories of my family and my community. And in October last year, I made kind of the reverse journey because I went to live in India for 10 months. And one of the projects that I ended up doing there was editing this anthology of stories of LGBT people in India. And I have been out for more than 20 years now, and in that time, I've read everything that I could get my hands on that seemed like it had a little bit of Indian and a little bit of gay in it. So I've been very hungry for that, and I've read everything there is to read out there. And when I started reading submissions for this anthology, 100 or 120, I was blown away because these were stories I'd never seen anywhere. They are incredible, and just there's such a wealth of untold, unknown material because these narratives have been so buried and so submerged. And so it's been very exciting to learn these stories. I'll just offer a few reflections on what seems to be happening in India right now. 2 years ago, the High Court of Delhi decriminalized homosexuality. That is, it overturned a law that dated back from Victorian British rule of India that made homosexuality illegal. And so that decision, which was the result of an amazing coalition of activists and legal advocates, has actually changed quite a lot in India in the sense that now it is apparently safer to be out, and it's also created this kind of great public dialogue. So today in India, almost every day in the papers or every other day, you'll see a story that touches on gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender issues. It might be a story of a couple who's had to run away from their village because their families are objecting to their relationship, and it's a young couple, and so maybe the family's filed kidnapping charges against one girl who looks more boyish for kidnapping the other girl who looks more girlish. This is a really common narrative. Probably in the course of my 10 months in India, there were 5 to 7 such cases. It might be an advice column where someone's writing in saying, I have these desires. What do you recommend? And the advice itself is not always of the highest quality, but the fact that the questions are there and are being published is quite new in India. It might be a cover story in Forbes magazine about corporate gay and lesbian activism and how people are trying to come out in their workplaces and agitate for non-discrimination policies and domestic partnership benefits. So really across the spectrum from rural to urban, from the poorest classes to the upper classes, this dialogue about homosexuality and about non-conforming gender is really alive right now. It's kind of an amazing moment there. There are a couple of trends that I see happening. One is the shift from a kind of undercover behavior that was just integrated into a basically heterosexual structure. So in the past, it would be fairly normal for people to be married, and maybe the man would have a girlfriend on the side, maybe he'd have a boy toy on the side, but as long as those relationships were kind of kept secret and didn't threaten the main family unit, the wife and the children, they were considered to be okay, and many, many people were okay with that kind of arrangement. It wasn't really considered the greatest thing, but it wasn't the worst thing either. It could be incorporated. Now, you see more people who actually want to make sexuality a part of their identity. In other words, to structure their lives around their sexual orientation. And that is a fairly new phenomenon, and it is happening definitely more in the urban areas and in the middle and upper middle classes as young people have more disposable income. Young women especially have these call center jobs and things like that that give them a little bit of freedom, a little bit of space outside the family structure. So that shift from a kind of unspoken behavior status to a more sexual orientation identity is happening, although I think it is not taking the form that it is taken in the West, where people really take that as a primary identity. So, for example, one person that I have spoken to at length about this talks about how, you know, her primary identity is really her caste group, and then she's an Indian, and she's a woman, and she has her job, which is a big part of her identity, and then somewhere down the list, yes, she's a lesbian, but it's not the most important thing in her life. It's not one of two or three primary important factors. So it's an interesting shift, and one that is being navigated in a really particular way. Another thing that we're seeing emerge as a result of that is the pink rupee, so kind of businesses going after the gay market, and that again is happening in kind of the urban areas. Time Out magazine in Bombay just launched something called the Q card, which is a kind of discount card that you subscribe to and you pay a certain amount per year, and then you get a directory of queer and queer-friendly businesses that will give you a discount if you take your card into their store. Then there's also an amazing transgender movement in India. Transgenderism has a long history in India, and so there are interesting things happening with that. The Indian census this year for the first time counted people as male, female, and other. There is a state in the south, Tamil Nadu, that has recently secured a special status for transgender people, which allows for certain kinds of government benefits and affirmative action to then be offered through the government. So, and you're seeing traditionally the transgender community in India that's been the most visible has been people who were born with biologically male bodies who transition to female or to some in-between third gender space. Now you're also beginning to see people who are in female bodies who are becoming male and who feel that they've always been boys, always been men, and there's starting to be some space for that. It's very local. It's very isolated, and a lot of people are still alone and not in touch with the community, but there are these small pockets of community happening. So it's really been amazing and a great education for me, and I think the biggest thing that I see really happening in India now is that there is a public dialogue where before there was a vast public silence, and that is the most exciting thing to see. Thanks.
Thank you, Manal. And now questions from the audience. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is entitled Spice of Life, Growing Up Queer in India. In some Asian countries, homosexuality is considered to be a Western concept that is incompatible with being Asian. In fact, on July 5, 2011, Indian Union Health Minister Azad called homosexuality something that came to India from foreign shores. It was a disease that was absolutely unnatural. Does India have a concept of homosexuality that has grown organically from within the culture? And are there tensions between Muslim and Hindu gay Indians? And what role does class play in any relationship in India today? So I will open up to the whole panel for all or part of that multiple part question.
I think I can speak about the health minister of India. He made a comment public in his public speech, and he said homosexuality was a disease. It was a Western import. And I think the queer community in India and also elsewhere outside of India has really stood up against this speech. Unfortunately, he has not yet made any public apology. We here in the Bay Area, Tricon, had a demonstration outside the Indian consulate a few weeks ago, and we gave a written statement asking for an apology and also ousting of the health minister, because if anyone, the health minister of a country should be aware that homosexuality is not a disease. As far as whether there's any differences between the gay Hindus and Muslims, personally, I have never come across that sort of difference. I think Hinduism does not openly speak about homosexuality, but at the same time, it does not condemn it. So there are instances in scriptures where there are a lot of transgender characters in mythology, and so gender is sort of fluid, and that's why in Hinduism, people don't have that much of religious, you know, it's not said in any of the scriptures that homosexuality is a sin. In Islam, there have been references where people, they've said homosexuality is a sin. And so people who are, you know, Muslims, they have a hard time, sort of finding common grounds between their sexuality and their religion. But as far as the gay Hindus and Muslims, I don't think there's any kind of, fight.
I think the issue in India has a lot more to do with class. Yeah. I think Hindus and Muslims of equal class get along fine. But I think it's people accessing services or being able to know what's available based on what class you are can make a difference. And I think that's maybe more of an issue than just Hindu-Muslim.
I think that both Hinduism and Islam are right now in sort of heated debate each within themselves between the right-wing, conservative-driven forces and the more kind of liberal, open forces on this particular topic of homosexuality. There are, you know, fascists within both religions, and there are also long liberal streams. And Islam, while it does have scriptural prohibitions, it also has the long tradition of Sufism, in which there are these amazing, gorgeous examples of poetry that are from a male devotee to a beloved, and that's considered to be a very exalted and divine form of love to a male beloved. So there are a couple of books that are edited collections by Ruth Vanita and Salim Kidwai, and they have both done amazing work in excavating the historical documentation for the long tradition of same-sex love in India. And I think those collections are really an attempt to create and demonstrate the counter-argument to this whole idea that homosexuality is a Western import. There's also a lovely book by a scholar named Giti Thadani called Sakiyoni, which in which she excavates thousands of years of sculptural as well as scriptural evidence of lesbianism, particularly. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention about class is that it's really the biggest thing in India in any topic, and the class disparity is so extreme there. The spectrum is so amazing that any issue, if you look at the poorest person and the richest person and their experience of it, it's really vastly different. So at the upper end, in my view, for gay people, there's quite a lot of privilege because it's possible to create this sort of private zone where you, within your household, with your servants and your friends, you create this zone where anything you do is more or less acceptable. Whereas for the poorest people, there's so little agency in a lot of areas of life that even the freedom to, you know, have potable water to drink is something that people struggle with on a day-to-day basis. So within that, the struggle for sexual freedom is certainly there, but maybe is a lower on the priority compared to other survival needs. So the organizing that I see happening is happening with people who are somewhere between those zones of just, you know, so much privilege that they don't need a movement and so little agency that they don't have space to be activists around this particular issue. Somewhere in the middle, there is a class of people who have enough privilege in other areas of their life that then they can also create some space to fight for this. And many of the activist organizations are kind of run by these kinds of volunteers or not very well-paid staff members, but the clientele are often, particularly in the HIV/AIDS work, are often people who are sex workers and other people who are more vulnerable to the kinds of risks that are out there.
What is the importance of LGBTQ issues in Bollywood, if any? And when you were growing up, were there any public figures who were gay or lesbian that you looked up to?
Everyone sees Rakesh as the Bollywood spokesperson.
No, there's not been any openly out person in Bollywood, although, you know, there are always people claiming so-and-so to be gay or lesbian. In fact, one of the biggest movie producers, people have known him to be gay, but he's not out. So no, as far as Bollywood, I don't think there are any role models. What was the second part of the question?
Did you have any role models when you were growing up?
Not really, no. There were no role models. So the first role model that I came across was, like I said, Ashok Rao Kavi, who was the, gay activist. For a long time, there was a standing joke in the media that he was the only gay in India. Because any kind of gay event or any kind of issue, and he would be asked to comment. So in the media, there would be just one comment from Ashok Rao Kavi. So. But yeah, I did look up to him.
Speaking of role models, I mean, in Hindi films, in Bollywood films, there have been lots of films where there have been these songs about these great friendships among the two main heroes in the movie. And you can always, gay people have always taken those to be sort of hidden subtext within the songs as to whether the characters are gay or not.
Do you find more discrimination in your life today as an Indian in America or as a gay person in mainstream society?
I think that kind of question is really problematic, actually. The idea that oppressions can be ranked and should be put in some kind of hierarchy like that, I really have no way to answer a question like that, and I think there's some silence on the panel because we're like, ooh, you know, it hurts either way, and one is not more or less than the other. We live in a racist place and country sometimes, and we live in a homophobic place and country sometimes, and neither one is really okay.
Although I must say that living in the Bay Area, we're pretty much shielded from either of these forms of discrimination for the most part.
I tend to disagree. I mean, I think discrimination happens anywhere. It's less in the Bay Area, of course. There are always subtle ways that you face discrimination. It's not always overt. But yes, discrimination does happen, whether it be racist or it be about your sexual orientation, in many ways.
So, Devesh, you mentioned that you were asked if you were going to get married. Were any others of you ever betrothed to be married?
Well, I think my family knew I wasn't going to get married. They'd have to look somewhere else. But, you know, I didn't actually come out till I was like 26 or 24. And, but I think I come from actually a very liberal South Asian family. My father and my parents were very accepting of me, and I think that also shaped why I feel a need to be visible, because I think lots of my friends don't have that same support, and I want to be there and be able to let other parents know that it's okay if your kid is gay. And so I think, yeah, for me that was really... I just lost my train of thought. That happens when you have as much gray as I do.
A lot of your coming out stories are very universal in their tone and their facts. Are you aware of any different coming out experiences that can be attributed to a purely Indian cultural influence?
I'll tell you my coming out story very quickly. It's nothing short of a Bollywood movie, and I'll cut out the details. But basically, I came out literally out of the closet. I had some photographs of me kissing a boy I was dating at that time, and they were in my closet in an album, and they were on the top shelf. And for some reason, my mom opened my closet, and the album literally fell out and opened to the page where I was kissing this boy. So yeah, it couldn't have been any, you know, it's literally like a Bollywood movie.
You know,
gosh, my life seems like a Bollywood movie. I'm sorry.
I find this idea of a purely Indian story very entertaining, because I actually think we live in a globalized world, and you know, our stories might sound universal, but it's partly because we're living in America and we're telling them in English, and they're just human stories. And we're in a room of LGBT people, and so we have these stories. It's hard for me to figure out what's like a purely lesbian moment in my life and what's a purely Indian moment in my life. They're kind of, none of them are very pure.
So I have a funny story to tell about that. I think it may not be purely Indian, but I think most Indians in this room will at least get a chuckle out of it. So my mother actually asked me if I was a lesbian. That's how I came out. And she was in my living room, and she asked me. And my mom introduced me to my first girlfriend as an adult. So I thought she couldn't hate her too much. And then she went home and told my father. So I didn't have to come out to my father. And then I got a call from my father. I was in college. And I got a call from my father, and he says, "Okay, now I know you're a lesbian, but please don't let that interfere with your studies." And I promptly, that year, I don't think I went to class. I discovered bars, and I discovered staying up all night. So that was my coming out.
From what I've heard, also it's been more difficult for guys at least to come out to their dads as opposed to their moms. My father passed away when I was pretty young, so I didn't have the experience of coming out to my dad. But from a lot of my friends, they especially when they came out to the moms, the moms specifically told them, don't tell their dads, because of this male dominance in society, in Indian society.
The time has come now for our last question. And today we have heard your stories, and thank you for sharing your stories with us. How do you think it will be different, if any, for children and teenagers now who are LGBT and Indian?
Just recently there was news that several colleges in India now have gay student groups, which is a brand new thing. So I think that is really amazing and will certainly change the environment for the students who have access to that kind of thing. I do think that there is now a generation of kind of liberal urbanites who are starting to have their own children and who maybe will be a little bit more relaxed about policing their children's sexuality.
I think in India, we Indians put a lot of pressure on getting married. So I've noticed recently, of late, what is happening is, earlier parents would say, well, arrange a marriage for their sons or daughters. And now when the sons or daughters are coming out, they're like, okay, you're gay, so now let's find a partner for you. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there were a lot of, like, arranged same-sex marriages that start happening in India and the pressure mounting on gay sons and daughters to get married.
You have been listening to a program of the LGBT Member-Led Forum of the Commonwealth Club. Our thanks to our four superstar panelists tonight, Rakesh Modi, Dipti Ghosh, Devesh Katu, and Minal Hadratwala. Thank you, one and all, for being here. And now this concludes the meeting of the Commonwealth Club, setting truth free in the world for 107 years.